ChewCast! Welcome back to Finland's 17th most popular style podcast, the Stitch Down ChewCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things that we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, along with Wegmans chic cake influencer Ticho Blanco, and we've got one of our favorite people in the entire shoe game on the ChewCast this week, Wyatt Gilmore, founder of Grant Stone, the very, very excellent brand that is pretty much always my first answer whenever somebody asks, what are the best bang for the buck shoes I can buy? Because they really are. But before we get to Wyatt, we need to give an ecstatic shout out to our sponsor this week, Standard & Strange, one of the finest Viberg and Wesco retailers in the entire game, and the shop that finally convinced me just how damn cool engineer boots can be. Standard & Strange is also one of the presenting sponsors, along with Grant Stone, I'll have you know, of the Stitchdown Patina Thunderdome, the seven-month judged boot and shoe aging competition with over $10,000 in prizes, mostly boots. The dome starts on October 1st. Wyatt is a judge, and all entrants need to be a member of the simply wonderful Stitchdown Premium community, so do what needs to be done and head to stitchdown.com to learn more. This thing is going to be a blast, and we'd love to see all of you and your boots and shoes and whatever's in there. Although, really, they have to be boots and shoes. No sandals. I'm sorry. But all right, Ticho, let's do this. I've got some Grant Stone coffee suede diesel boots on because we've got Wyatt here. Wyatt, huge, huge thanks for coming on the ShoeCast. And I think you know the first question. What are you wearing today?
Yes, thank you, guys. This will be fun. And not to bring up too many coffee references here, but I have the espresso suede traveler loafers on, which I just changed into about an hour ago from the coffee tassel loafer. So yeah, a lot of suede and loafers today.
It's like a more powerful leather, more concentrated.
Yeah, it is. It is darker. You know, it almost has like a gray color to it. It's actually the darkest brown that I could find in a suede. So it was, yeah, it's a really cool color.
TJ, what about you? Let's do the what are you wearing thing that we have kind of gotten bad at recently.
I'm really glad that you have asked me what shoes I'm wearing. I knew we were talking to Wyatt today. So, of course, had to go for my Grant Stones. Got my Cognac Pebble Grain Country Derbies, which have proven to be a favorite of mine in the spring-summer here. I've got some nice olive laces in them from our buddy Jesse at Guarded Goods, who I think is also a Thunderdome judge, correct?
Another Thunderdome judge, amazing.
Little Thunderdome judge collab on these shoes. I didn't know we were doing a coffee thing. I would have poured coffee on them. I don't know. I don't know how I would have complied with that.
Those things look like they can take it.
These things almost certainly could take, whether drip coffee, espresso, whatever you want to pour on them. Wyatt can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe this leather, this pebble grain, it's a Horween Latigo. Is that right? That then has this lovely pebble grain texture on it. Am I misremembering?
No, it's correct. It's the glace Latigo, which definitely wouldn't be like your typical pebble grain choice, I guess, for a shoe, because anything Horween is going to be really heavy. It's going to be thick. It's from like a large bovine animal just to begin with, a rawhide. So you might get like a, you know, the typical kind of loose grain on some of them, but obviously they're very good at the pebble grain leather, doing what they do with the football hides and everything, the football skin. So we tried it out and it was like, you know, honestly, instead of doing a French calf, or you could have got it from a few different tanneries, this one actually looked pretty solid. And the way that shoe is built, it's heavy, right? Like it's for the good or bad, you know, it's heavy. And so like putting the Horween leather on it and, you know, making it like a true, I guess, country derby, you can wear it and kind of beat it up. And it's not necessarily going to be the pair that you're polishing all the time and wearing a suit with. I don't think many of our customers wear a suit with that shoe technically. So, you know, it's just kind of like truly like a shoe you can kind of beat up and stuff. So it worked out. I did try a couple different pebble grains, and we had a German calfskin at one point. We made like a dark brown pebble grain. That was more of your like the English shoemaker would buy that type of leather for pebble grain. You know, like really good breaks throughout. Just a really nice like smaller calf pebble grain, really sharp. But it's a very different leather, right? So the Horween stuff, it's the same old thing. Like super gutsy. You know, you've got your highs and lows. You can kind to do whatever you want to it, and you know, it'll last forever. So
I like gutsy. We need to start calling more leathers gutsy. I love that.
Yeah, it's a good word for that. It is, yeah.
It's perfect. Why are you so good at this? Another thing I'm expecting you to be very good at, Wyatt, Patina Thunderdome judging. We're so psyched to have you on. You mentioned Jesse from Guarded Goods, one of the people who just knows and handles more leather than anybody I know. Vic Sow from Dr. Soul, another sponsor. But we're really expecting the most out of you of all these people. What are you going to be looking for? A lot of people are hunting for, and I'm writing stories and, you know, doing collaborations, promoting, oh, this leather is going to age wildly. But, you know, that's not the whole thing. What else should people know who are going to be entering that you as a judge might be keeping an eye out for?
Well, can I start this reply out with a question?
No.
Okay, fair.
Yes, do it. Fine.
I guess, you know what's strange is, like, go back, like, maybe even 5 years ago or 10 years ago, was, like, patinaed leather on footwear specifically, was that a thing? Because obviously now it definitely is. I mean, there's people who start Instagram accounts just for it. And because there's a lot to look at, right? Like, it's a real, it looks very, very rich, and it really highlights the leather, because obviously there's only certain leathers, like aniline leathers, actually patina naturally. So it says a lot about the leather to have the patina. But, like, I remember going on, like, these travel, like, shop trips for footwear back when I was developing for other brands. That wasn't a thing, especially if I was looking for things online for social media, or you look at brands that were selling things. I guess the one thing they do was, like, they would make a vintage looking, like, finish. You didn't hear a lot of talk about patina. Like, do you guys kind of feel the same way? Like, that's only been the last, like, 4 or 5 years where it, like, really started to, like, become a thing.
I think that's pretty fair. I know when I first got into this, you know, you certainly had customers who appreciated that kind of thing. And there were people looking for boots and shoes that were going to patina nicely. But I feel like, yeah, it's only in the last couple of years that brands have really kind of capitalized on that interest and are starting to, you know, specifically market products that are going to develop a really cool, interesting patina. So that's been pretty cool to see. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that so people have been making boots out of leather, and you look at old boots and they look great. But you're right. Like, it might have been more of a byproduct of just wearing them, and you choose a leather as a maker, Red Wing, for instance, because it's going to last a long time and it can take it. And then naturally from that flows these interesting changes in it. But yeah, I mean, I think there were, like, a couple flashpoints, like the Andrew Chen Viberg service boots in the harness leather. Andrew being, you know, the guy who started 316, got these boots from Brett and wore the hell out of them, like, all winter long in New York, and then posted them on the Super Future forum thread, boots that look better with age, or shoes that look better with age, or whatever it's called. So it already existed at the time, and that was, I don't know, 7 years ago or something.
Right.
And everybody just freaked out, and they're like, I want those. I need to have those. And, like, they didn't have any more of the leather, and, you know, there was kind of this, like, chase that started after that. But yeah, I mean, he just wore them honestly. And, you know, part of it is about how the leather ages. Part of it is about how that boot with an unstructured toe, you know, just kind of how the look of the boot changed in terms of everything kind of collapsing in one way or another. So yeah, it's really interesting. I know, like, when I was just getting into this, and or maybe a little bit after that, but I had a couple pairs of Red Wings, and, you know, they were looking good. And I had a pair of Alden Indies in brown Chrome XL. And then I saw this one picture, maybe two existed, of these Alden Roy plain toe, also brown Chrome XL boots from Context Clothing. I became obsessed with this picture, and they were absolutely beautiful and, like, the most, you know, simple boot, but just so wonderfully worn. Brown Chrome XL, which is, you know, a leather that I feel like some people are underrating for a competition like this. I couldn't not talk myself into getting these things even before I was kind of, you know, buying more boots than I was previously. I saved up some money and got them, and I'm like, okay, how do I wear these things to make them look like this? And that grabbed me personally and said, I know what these things can become. And I think that, you know, that's going to be one of the cool things about the competition, is that we're going to have a ton of photos from everybody, and everybody will be able to look into the future of, you know, various leathers and patterns and stuff from different makers, which I think is going to be really interesting and very helpful to people down the line.
Right. And there's a certain thing there. And the reason I mentioned, like, bringing up going on a shopping trip and looking at things, because we're looking at, like, leathers. And a lot of times, I mean, truth be told, the footwear scene is pretty bad. Like, it's very, very boring in a general sense. If you go visit one city, it doesn't matter if it's New York, it doesn't matter if it's Chicago, even if you go to Tokyo, you're going to have to go see a lot of other shops that carry leather goods and this and that, and to touch on those things, to try to find kind of, like, what you're looking for, and to kind of get a feel for what's going on. Because just footwear, you know, shops in general, you know, there's not that many of them, especially selling, like, what you'd be looking for. And that leather, I guess, going back to that whole thing with these leathers that are tanned with certain things. It doesn't have to be veg necessarily, but they actually age and they're made that way. Obviously, you know, the other context would be like saying if you go to New York City, sometimes people say it's kind of like airport shopping. It's like you have your big name brands and, you know, the fashion brands. And so, yeah, you can like go check out their leather goods and everything, but everything pretty much is, you know, it looks like it's kind of pigmented, right? Like you could use their wallet for 3 years and it looks pretty much the exact same as when you bought it to begin with. You know, to go see some like interesting things with these, like your favorite word, these gutsy leathers, you know, these pull-ups and, you know, oil and wax and stuff. It's hard to come by, right? And so actually, like, I'll answer the question here at this last little bit here. But one of the best stores that we would go to in Tokyo was, Butero. Butero. I never actually bought a pair of their boots. I have a pair of their shoes, but like their leather goods and stuff, it's all using like veg tanned for these bags. They're like these big cuts of veg tanned stuff and it's sitting on a rack, but it's already kind of like patinaing from people just holding them and everything. And it's like, there's very few companies that actually do that in like the mainstream space, actually using stuff like that. And outside of like what we do, our small little market, I guess. So our small little world. Yeah, it's just kind of unique to see that. And so it's pretty cool to see all of these people and that actually enjoy that type of product. I mean, really, you do. You have to use pretty good materials, grand scheme of things, because I'm putting everything in, you know, majority of leather is $1 square foot, you know, $1.50 square foot. It's automobile leather. It's this and that. I mean, it's anything that you buy that's kind of imported for a bag or something. It's kind of pigmented and it doesn't age like that. So there's something to be said for that. You know, it kind of highlights those better leathers, I guess. So what would be looking for? To me, like when it starts to like patina naturally, it always kind of goes like obviously the toe and the heel first because you're kicking things or whatever. Your foot's like resting on the inside of like your car, your desk at your office or whatever you're doing, you know. So you can kind of tell when it's like kind of like that natural color, having the highs and lows. And then probably the coolest thing about it is you just don't know, right? Like one of the coolest leathers that color wise, it's almost like a yellow. It's like this, they call them like, I mean, I've heard a lot of people refer to it as an English tan, but it's more of like a yellow. Think like the, you know, like the deerskin gloves that like Lafaux sells or something like that. Mm-hmm. Really, it's almost like a true yellow, but it's kind of like rich, like that type of thing when that, like it turns into like this golden, like burnt crisp, like that is a really, really sharp, like caramelized look. And I know some of the, like the heritage boot brands, they'll use some of those leathers, but I don't know, to me, that's a good one. It's kind of like our saddle tan, but it's even more yellow. It's not as brown. It's more of like a yellow, but it's tough to say because sometimes you look at like a black Chrome XL, it looks like a T-core after half a year. It has like all the tannish brown kind of showing up from underneath. And then you have like with Chrome XL, you just kind of like brush it and it has a sheen. So there's a lot of just like who'd grab a black boot. They can actually look pretty awesome. So
I hope people do.
Right.
Shoe
right.
Enabler will, or boy, Carlo.
There's a lot to look at there, but I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting because I really don't know what to expect. Like, are people going to be like polishing them up and everything, or just like beating them to hell? And then, so I'm sure you get a little bit of everything, you know?
We're going to see.
Right.
It should be fun. Everybody knows how to make Wyatt happy and win some stuff. We think that everybody should know everything about Grant Stone already, but some people might not. The Grant Stone origin story to me, and especially your journey to get to say, hey, I need to make a shoe company based on what you were doing previously, to me is really interesting. I'd love for you to share that with everybody.
At the time, I was kind of like have a choice to go to like college or what are you going to do next with your life as an adult? And so my dad, you know, he worked at Alden for how many years that was, 15 to 20 years back closer to the 80s and through, I think, most of the 80s before he met a person who owned a shoe factory at that time. I want to say it was kind of like in transition from Taiwan to China. And so it's a Taiwanese family. And so he ended up meeting this guy named Leo. They hit it off. Really, really enjoyed being around Leo. Thought he was a really smart guy. Leo was, you know, trying to kind of change and adapt what they were currently making. My dad kind of got involved there. That's when they started to make Goodyear Welt boots. But it was more like, okay, what does the customer need? What is this customer talking to? And let's kind of develop for them on our side in China. So like my dad went there and kind of went through the whole thing with them and was kind of like helping a little bit on that side. But also kind of the main thing was he was the liaison for the factory, or, you know, he was going out to get a customer for the factory. So that's kind of how their relationship started with this factory and this family. That was 1994. When I was at this point, I don't know, this was 12 years ago, he was thinking of, well, what should I do if I go to school? What's next? Dad said, well, you know, I talked to Andy, who was Leo's son, who then had then taken over. You know, he said, you're welcome to go over and look at the factory. And I'd really suggest doing that. Get out, and go see something different. And this has nothing to do with work or go get a job. This is go see what's out there a little bit. Before that, I was homeschooled and kind of racing motocross. So I did not have something like specifically in front of me, like, oh, I'm going to go to school and be a CPA or something. So,
which is the best, by the way. I love that that was part of your past. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, but it kind of like sets you up, you know, to be like, once you're done, you're kind of like starting over. You definitely were not planning to go to college or do any of that, right? Realistically. So it's like, yeah, just go do that. Go check it out for a month. And Andy said you could like live with him and bunk with him up a little bit. He's there every week. Yeah, no big deal. So I was like, definitely, I'll definitely do that. You know, at the same time, as that kind of came closer, that date, it was kind of like, hey, probably shouldn't take this too casually, like, you know, get the most out of this thing. Don't go over there and just kind of like screw around type of deal. And like, well, you know, learn a little bit about the shoe, you know, the shoe industry and try to learn some things and retain whatever you pick up while you're over there. And so, you know, long story short, at the time I was down south, we found this shoemaker in Oregon, D.W. Frommer. And he's like, let's go to D.W. Frommer. He makes bespoke boots, right? The last and everything. So like true bespoke, making everything by himself, all the way down to cutting, finishing, everything. Went to Oregon, did D.W. Frommer's class. Yeah, it was probably one of the coolest experiences, basically because Frommer's like, he's a total character in itself. He's a very unique person from my experience and from what I've, you know, heard other people say. He's very, very good at what he does. He takes it incredibly seriously. And for him, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's 100% a lifestyle. This is what I do, and I'm going to be the best at it 100%. And so it was cool to kind of spend time with him and do that. I think the class was like a month long. Yeah, that was a great experience. So that was like literally right before my trip to China for the first time. Got to do that, which was very cool. Basically, you learn how to build a boot and you make your own pair of Western boots, you know, bespoke boots based on your foot and make a last, whatever, and so on. So that was a really cool experience. From there, went over to China. First was in Taipei, where our main office is. Still there from when they first had the factory in Taiwan. And so we still have, you know, still have like, you know, some colleagues over there. Spent a few days there, went to China. And after spending a few weeks there, kind of showing me around and learning about it, for me, it was so different, so interesting, so cool. He was like, do you want to stay longer? And I was all in. Basically, just the plan was for me to become or learn enough things to kind of go into this development role for the factory and then the production side for the factory for a single account. And of course, like this factory, it's all Chinese and Taiwanese. So I was the only Westerner there. It's like, yeah, let's do it. I'd say for the first 6 months, it was kind of like spend 3-4 weeks in every station, leather warehouse, cutting, the nesting, the patterns, you know, then you go up to the upper stitching down to kind of lasting and prepping the shoes for like putting the inseam, you know, for the welt on, kind of like the finishing, which is just after attaching the soles and the whole thing. So kind of like the 4 or 5 main stages, kind of spending just about a month at each one and kind of learning a little bit. And of course, I didn't speak Chinese and not very many of them spoke English, with the exception of like the development team in the office. That was, yeah, I mean, that was it's a great experience, right? Definitely hard at the time because I was like a 20-year-old punk for sure. Just like trying to learn a little bit, trying to really take most of it in and like understand a little bit, but at the same time struggling with the majority of it, especially with the language side of it. Either I kind of like learn the language or I don't. So it was like a year or two when I started like going to school after work and just to finally learn the language, because that was pretty, it was difficult. It was difficult to really get a whole lot done. It's pretty apparent, like if I was going to really stay there long term and do production side of things or even development, I mean, you have to be able to communicate, you know. That's kind of how that all started and how I ended up staying there. And so like after the first year, it's like, I'm in. It's not like, well, here you can stay for a year and we'll see how things go. And then we can go from there. It was just like, once we were 4 or 5 months in, just kind of like my family, I'm living with them in a dorm, Chinese New Year, these different holidays. Obviously, I don't know anyone or I don't have friends and family in that country. So I'm like going to their house with their kids. And it's just like, you're basically just family at that point. So then it's just, that's all it is, right? It's just, this is your life and you're together. Like you're working together. We have dinner together every day. We have lunch together every day. And that's just your life. It was a very different. It was like the furthest thing you could imagine from corporate. It's basically like, okay, you're part of the family now. As long as, you know, you do what you say you're going to do.
That's cool though, right?
It's very cool, yeah.
It's not, who gets that from a good job in a real sense, you know?
Yeah.
Not some fake family that they make up.
Right. And so, yeah, they went a little bit like above and beyond as far as, I mean, obviously they didn't have to invite me to their home for Chinese New Year. They didn't have to do all this type of stuff. But yeah, it was very inviting. And there's a Chinese word for it, just the not drama, but just gossip, right? So it's like within like the first month, obviously they all know like I'm like staying there and like I don't have any family there and I'm living with Andy or whatever. And so everyone kind of treats you the same way. Like, yeah, how can we help? You know, if I have to go to the doctor or dentist, it's like I need someone to go with me from the company to help me, right? Like for the first year or two, right? Because I couldn't speak or anything like that. So it was very, very cool in that sense, where it's just like you're immediately part of a family. So, I mean, that was kind of all the difference in the world right there, because then I didn't have any concessions or thinking, you know, doubts of like, yeah, kind of what am I doing? Or like, this is a stage for me. Like, what's my next step after this? It's never really like that. It's like, no, this is what we're doing. And then what's next is just, yeah, whatever we have to do as a factory to make it work.
I love it. When was Grant Stone the next thing then?
At the time, the factory, so like Andy and my dad, they had tried to do Grant Stone back in the day. When I say that, like 6 years before I got there, maybe 5 years before I got there, it's like 2005, 2006, something like that. They tried to do Grant Stone, but at the time they were doing wholesale, right? Like direct to consumer hardly existed. They weren't going to start a Shopify account and like, let's start, you know, warehousing shoes and selling them. So Andy had a very good sense as well when it comes to like the leather, shoemaking, last, things like that. I mean, the majority of what I learned over there, I mean, I'm learning from them. So it was like, they had a very good idea of these things. And so even when they tried back whenever that was, 2005, 2006, the shoes were good, but it was like, they were doing bucks. But, you know, they were using like CFstead leather. They were using like Thiele lining. They were using leather insoles. Like the full deal is, you know, it's any other brand, you could buy that. It's a $550 shoe, right? A $450 shoe at the bottom of the, you know, price point. So they were making a good shoe, but they were selling them like, I think they were trying to find a couple accounts, which they know a lot of people, but it's like they need small, they need 24 pair of this, 16 pair of that. And it's just like handling that. You know, I think kind of the way it went down was it was just kind of too much at the time. It was something they wanted to do long term, but it just wasn't going to work out. So like Shoemart Sepakas from Connecticut, you know, our friends there, they were one of the first guys to like take it on and be like, yeah, you know, we'll definitely do this, you know? And so they had some of the original Grandstone shoes, but it was one of those things, again, you really have to service those accounts. I need an 8D, I need an 11.5D, I need this, and that. And so it's so much work. Even for what we do today, how we're set up, it's a lot of work to do it correct and to really help these brick and mortar guys out. As Patrick, I'm sure you know how that is. It's a total grind. And, you know, as soon as you're sold out, like you need replenishment, you need these things coming in constantly. So that was kind of snuffed out and they decided to kind of, I mean, let it go. And just kind of go back to what they're doing, kind of manufacturing and helping a brand, you know, build a private label. So I would say that didn't even last. I mean, it was probably for like a year or something like that. They were trying to make this thing work and then just said, hey, this is a whole nother battle here, you know? So probably I was there for probably seven years or something, you know, because I was making samples for other companies, development stuff. And of course, we kind of already had these connections with tanneries, Battle Assy, whoever. So like, you know, we'd making these development samples for some of these brands. Then sometimes we'd like pull out everything and make this really cool shoe or boot as far as components go. And of course, it never added up, right? Like they're like, oh, well, see, our retail needs to be $179. And this is $400. This,
nope.
You know, cool shoe. Can I get a pair for my, you know, for myself? But we're not buying these, you know, we're not buying these things. And sorry, making them in China and selling for $400 is not happening. So that was pretty much the story for every single year I ever did anything. You know, the whole development phase is, which I mean, that's how that goes for most places. I mean, the things that, you know, your customers see, like or the Stitch Down browser sees, or you know, part of that community. I mean, you're looking at the highest end footwear really in the world, right? Whether you're talking about the likes of Viberg or Edward Green or Alden. I mean, this is a very, very, very small little portion of footwear. It's very, very specific. It's very high end and it's not big. It's not big. And so if we're trying to make samples that are in that realm out of China and like it's cool, but like it wasn't even relatively a possibility. And there was a couple times where we got close and towards the end, we had one account where we were actually able to use like three or four of our tanneries and they were okay with it. And it was because of the people. It was the designer and his boss and the merchant there. They were all in, but we'd already been in business with them for a few years. We had a good relationship. They trusted us. And so we slowly could start to like build a better grade product. And, you know, the price points got higher and higher where they really had something. It was pretty cool because for, you know, these private label brands that are bigger to sell something that they make and their own label on it for, you know, $300 is pretty unique. You know, I mean, the sweet spot's $150 to $220. $20. So to be like literally a whole nother level, a step above that, it was pretty unique. And it was really fun while we had it because we could really make some cool products and they were on board. But as things change and things get hard, business up, down, whatever, you know, everyone kind of goes back to what they know. We need to get back to volume. We need to get back to, I mean, you know, for selling this at $300, imagine what would be, how many units we'd sell if it was $199. So long story short, that slowly, as this was happening, that's when it was like, we can do this with our own brand. I mean, it's going to be brutal because we're making them in China and no one knows who we are. We're not a brand. We don't have people yet. It's going to be very, very small, but it might be worth it. Let's actually try this thing direct to consumer. We can warehouse them. We'll build them exactly the way we kind of want to. If we can get the materials, let's build them that way. And in hindsight, it's kind of like a silly business model because anyone who's ever asked, they're kind of like, well, what was your like grand plan? You know, was it a price point? And it's like, yeah, not really, because
make some shoes.
Make shoes the way we like them.
We're going to make some shoes.
That sounds fun. So there was no big catalyst. You weren't doing anything crazy. It's just like, yeah, but there aren't that many options. Like how many Navy Chrome XL boots are on the market right now in a 7E? Like, can you even buy one? Maybe one other brand in the world sells that like today through a small store in like Seattle or something. Like it's a super small world. It wouldn't be that difficult to offer things that are hard to get or not even available, that don't even exist. It made sense to us. There's not a lot out there. No one was really doing it. I mean, I think Meerman is one exception, but I mean, to be fair, it's a pretty different, I mean, the product itself is, it's a different category. It's more of a European dress shoe, right? It's more refined. I love their stuff. I mean, their patterns are good. The way they finish them are good. I think Ben, you and I have talked about it before. Like, it was kind of joke around because people say like Meerman sometimes don't fit that well or they're hard to break in. And it's kind of like, you know, my take on it with you is, well, yeah, not really. It's, you know, they have the wrong size, like a lot of our customers and stuff. And
right.
It's like you're trying to wear 10 in their shoe and it's like, come on, it's a narrow last. You need to size up. I don't know. I've owned plenty of Meermans and they're made well. They do a good job. They have this like unique niche in what they do, but at the same time, it's not really our customer just because the way their last look, right? It's a very, very different product. Still in that small little niche world, they offer probably 70 dress shoes. Right now, we offer like 6 or 10 or something. So it's a very different business model, I think. That's kind of how it all came together. Like there wasn't this like one catalyst. It's like, oh, we're going to be so much cheaper than Allen Edmonds or something. The reality is most people buy Allen Edmonds at 10, 20% off or something. And we have plenty of customers tell me that, like, hey, yeah, your stuff's more than Allen Edmonds or whatever. It's like, sorry. I promise you we would sell them for less if we could, because, you know, when we have a sale, we sell more units. So we're aware we could have a better business if we could, you know, lower our prices somehow. We could have a bigger business that's even stronger. But it's very difficult to do that and make sure that's right. Because it's not like we joke around a little bit about it, how like people say that our quality control is good or B grades are good. And it's like, yeah, they are. And like, that's kind of what we'd like the average to be like, but we have problems every day. Hey, I have loose grain on this Ottawa boot, this left boot, the split toe is not straight. They don't match. Again, it's truly a grind to get that stuff right every single day. And try to keep it as clean as possible. It all kind of like worked out though. So we started to make the samples and stuff. And I don't know, at the time, I think I just made an Instagram account, Shopify. We made our first batch of shoes and plain toes and long wings, real basic shoes. We knew they fit well, whatever, like the Leo last, we had that, you know, in the making for a couple of years because we probably would have given it to a customer if we hadn't started Grant Stone. Definitely would have. So it was like, that's what that was for. Yeah, it just slowly started to add up. And even today, I mean, it's still a relatively small business in the grand scheme of things, especially if you put us in a footwear category, we're like a spec in the footwear category. And then in the niche, you know, we're still relatively small compared to a lot of people in that market. It's worked out. But I mean, if I had to say 5 years later now, I would have thought that it would be a little more, I guess, like it would be a little a smoother transition and growth, as in you would sell like more of one product, where that's 110% not the case. It's like you sell this much of one, but then you like bring out a new one and that really helps. And it creates a little bit of fire for the, you know, like something new, something fresh. I guess these old, like one particular style, it dies out quickly, or I should say it stabilizes quickly. And the upside of that though is, you know, it's not a Crocs business. Like, you know how people are like, always joke around like the Crocs, like whoever invented Crocs, it's like, can you imagine, you know, how many black Crocs are made in a factory per day? I mean,
too many.
that guy, he might as well have been a rocket scientist, right? Like what he found and how it worked out, right? Like you see Crocs, I'm sure plenty over the fourth weekend, right? So
you know this kind of stuff. What do you think it cost to, you know, make a Croc? Landed cost.
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know because
obviously it's a slightly different kind of footwear.
It's so different. I mean, it's dollars, right?
I think it's like $4. They're selling them for 40.
Yeah, it's got to be something like that. When you get into that too, I'm sure there's a lot of duties involved regardless of the country they're making them in. Either way, even I don't think like they're making a killing, like it's some crazy idea right now, because everyone's coming after them. They have been for a decade, right? So I'm sure it's competitive as hell, even in, you know, in that. But like when he first did it, right, he's just like, oh wow, I just found something here, you know. And I'm sure they're doing just fine, but it's just like we're like what we're doing, it's not so much. It's like the snowball effect happens like through the duration of your first newsletter send, and then it thaws out immediately. It's kind of like it's very, very slow, and there's no there's not a whole lot of depth in one style. I think that probably takes decades to kind of be like, okay, this boot or this shoe, it's doing that well. It can't be the pricing, right? It's going to be like, oh, this one's awesome because the clicking is good and the pattern, it's my favorite pattern, and the last is good. And so I don't know. I think we're seeing it a little bit now, but it's just very slow. That's all. It's very, very slow. 5 years in, you know, it takes a long time to get that consistency.
Well, it's not going to be slow after this episode.
That's right. That's right.
I love that story. I've heard it before and I would hear it again. And I'm happy for people who get to hear it the first time. It's just, it's a really cool, natural, organic origin story. And I'm glad that you told it. But let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with the Wyattcast. All right, fellas, it's time for Gen Facts. Jen works at Standard and Strange and finds nothing more joyous in life than tricking us with shoe facts that mostly aren't real. Here's how it works. We'll read three facts, two of which are outright lies, and at the end of the episode, we'll have to guess before revealing the correct, actually true fact. Ticho, hit it.
Okay, Gen Fact number one. The first boots with steel shanks were developed by Three Rivers Bootmakers, a footwear-based wing of Pittsburgh's Carnegie Steel. You going Carnegie or Carnegie?
I believe it's actually Carnegie, but I call it Carnegie.
I feel the exact same way about it. When Andrew Carnegie... That didn't sound good.
We're just trashing his memory here.
Yeah, shout out to Andrew Carnegie. The library thing is tight.
He's got a hall.
Everything else about like the Gilded Age robber barons, I'm out on, although interesting time. Anyway, when Andrew Carnegie saw an opportunity to expand the use of his fortune-making metal outside of a pure industrial use.
Three Rivers Bootmakers, nice name. Gen fact number two, the word vamp, generally the front part of a shoe, first emerged in 16th century Germany, at which time it was thought that a closed-toed shoe would more effectively protect wearers against vampires, who in German folklore were much smaller creatures that tended to feast on the feet of their victims while wandering the countryside.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a vampire scholar myself. It's a topic I find very interesting. I have never heard that, so I'm doubtful. But gen fact number three, in one of the greatest of all Victorian England traditions, old shoes were ruthlessly hurled by friends and family at brides and grooms upon the start of their honeymoon to wish the newlyweds good luck. We learned last week that they put them in houses.
And that was the true fact.
That was the true fact. I wonder if Jen just like fell down a rabbit hole of like English good luck shoe charms, kind of recycling it a little bit.
They apparently had a lot of extra shoes.
We're not really ones to talk, Ben. We would be... Like, everyone would be hitting us up all the time. They'd be like, we would get invited to every wedding just because they'd be like, do you have any extra shoes you could bring to the wedding? Also, we need some insulation for the walls of our house. Can I stop by and pick something out from your giant pile of boots? We would be very popular in Victorian England, I think, Ben.
Good time to be popular.
Those are three very specific. I didn't think it'd be this in-depth. Insane facts as well.
Yeah. That's kind of the vibe. Well, look, great insane facts, Jen. We'll circle back later in the episode to take some guesses at which one's true. Hang tight. And now back to the Wyattcast. Okay, we're back. So Wyatt, Grantstone started out with really wonderfully executed, but as you kind of alluded to, fairly straightforward boots and long wings. But over the past half decade, the line has really grown and gotten more and more creative and dare I say, fun. Some of them are on the same pattern. Some are on new patterns, but really wild kudu colors, those ostrich boots that you came out with. What do you see when you look back at that progression? And what does the Grantstone of tomorrow look like, if you even know?
You can definitely tell that we're not a company that like sits down and goes like, okay, this is our niche and we're just going to run with like, if we make a shoe, we have to do like five of them in various colors and then kind of like jump to the next pattern that makes sense just based on like aesthetic. Because if I look at it, it feels a tad random, just a little bit, but it's always kind of made sense to us. And it's, I would say the patterns and the leathers that we choose, it's a combination really of, if I had to say two things, one would be things that we're familiar with, like to wear slash enjoy making. And then the second one specifically is that we tend to know that we'd be better at making that particular style. For example, the boots in general, they're easier to make in like the sense of if you had 10 pair, the amount of things you can find wrong with it that would be questionable, you're not really going to find anything out of 10 pair. If you look at 100 pair, you know, you might find five pair or something like that, that like you could start to go like, hey, this, I don't know about this part or this, or, you know, all very small things. But in general, whether you're talking about welt joints, the way that you're lasting, the uppers, boots tend to be a little bit easier to make. And so, I mean, our cap toe shoes, we scrutinize those more than anything else, just because, first of all, we don't make dress shoes like day in, day out. They're very difficult to, not only lasting, but like, you don't want any type of imperfection on your calf dress shoe, right? Like it's got to be very, very clean. And when you finish it, you don't want it to be messy whatsoever. And it's like, well, you don't want to do the boot. And it's like, yeah, well, you kind of can. Like Chrome Excel or something, you can literally put, I mean, I'm not like when it comes to shoe cream and stuff, most of them do just fine. It doesn't matter if it's Saphir or Venetian, or they all do pretty good job. You can put something on it. And like, if it's a brown, you could put neutral on it. You could put three different shades of brown on it and stuff. And most people would not be able to tell the difference when you're done with it. Between these different methods and everything else, they really won't be able to tell that big of a difference. So the boots, and specifically because of the way they're made and the materials that are used, you can kind of get away with certain things that in their own right, other factories may have a hard time with. Maybe the footwear feels a little bit like light, or they don't feel like as substantial. Maybe they have, I don't know, maybe it's a welt joint thing, which would go for any type of product, whether regardless of the pattern. Definitely when we're making something new or whatever I'm developing now, almost the first thing that's come up is like, well, if we're not good at making it, like, what are we dealing with here? Like if it's not something that we've done in the past, or I know that's kind of related to what we currently do, what are we going to have to deal with? Because at the end of the day, the factory is going to try their hardest, and like the pattern maker and going down the line. But if it doesn't turn out right, then it's still kind of a problem, right? So that part of it, like the shoes, we've gotten better at them. But I mean, you see a dress shoe maker who only does, let's say, like 50% of the line are dress shoes. There's a lot there. Turn the shoe over, look at the outsole, look at the way the welts are beveled and the outsoles are beveled. Look at the stitch, look at the way the heel, the way that those are beveled or finished, or the tacks. There's a lot going on there. It really takes a lot of time and effort to do that properly, and then to make like 40 pair, and then for them all to look very good in their own way. Not so much consistent. Like consistency, in my opinion, is, you know, I think actually most people would say it's pretty overrated in better grade footwear. It's just like, does that pair look good, and is it doing what it's supposed to do? A dress shoe should be clean, it should be finessed, all that stuff. A boot should have kind of what it's looking for, especially. But you go to certain brands and you kind of get there, you know, you go to Red Wing and you want something just like chunky and really kind of rough and all that. And then if you go to Crockett and Jones, you expect something very, very different, very, very English. You kind of already know what the leather is going to be like. You kind of know how it's going to fit, but you expect it to be pretty clean as well. Like when we're making what we are right now, for example, the more recent Chukka, that was a tough one, because a Chukka, it's not like every brand has one and they're similar. They all kind of tend to be a little bit different. The only exception might be a couple of the American brands. They have something they kind of stick to. The pattern looks somewhat close, and the materials, I mean, you're just kind of using what you're using out of the other shoes and boots, but they're kind of close. But for us, it's just like, I don't want to put a leather sole on it or butyl or a rubber sole. Like it's really too similar to a lot of our boots for our first Chukka. Like, let's do something a little bit different. And I know I knew a lot of our customers were kind of be bummed out a little bit if it didn't have like a butyl sole on it or just like the rubber sole, just because those are so, I mean, you can use them kind of year round, and yeah, it's just, that's what they expect because that's what they, you know, they're used to seeing. But yeah, it was just something a little more fun, you know, that thick crepe sole, and it's different, you know, it makes that product quite a bit different from everything else that we currently sell. And the Chukka, I mean, honestly, it's a really weird one because it hits you like in the worst spot ever on your leg. You know, like that's what Chukkas are to me. And I've always disliked them because it was kind of like, okay, I'm not sure why we're going to make one of these things. I never really wear them. So it's like, let's try to use like softer materials or something. And then, so we started making a pattern a while back. It's like, yeah, this isn't so bad. I'm exaggerating here. It's, you know, these things aren't so bad, but it's like within millimeters, because sometimes if it's a little high, it can really hit you in, you know, on like the shin. And then if it's a little low, then you hit your ankle bone. So it's like a really strange thing. And then to make it worse, I'm like, okay, well, this one fits me really well, but I can't imagine the next person that has a higher ankle bone or like their leg is different, right? So it's kind of different for everyone. But when we're making the pattern, it's like it has to fit, be comfortable. And so like once you have that, I feel like it's like, okay, now what's this thing look like? You know, is it something that people are gonna be super familiar with? You know, are you doing like that Clark's Desert boot look? Or are we going more towards like the higher end American or English style Chukka that, you know, a lot of times is borderline dressy and you can put shell on it and so on. I don't know. I just tried different lines and different things with the pattern. And ultimately at one point I'm like, damn, this thing looks like a shoe. You know, I need to remember making a Chukka, you know, and like kind of go back a little bit more, make the vamp a little bit longer again and stuff. But I was like trying to get away from making a Chukka and make another shoe. But it ended up kind of being a mix of those two things. And so it looks very familiar to me. So like, that's kind of what I was comfortable with. So like for a lot of people, it was probably a little bit of a bummer because it didn't look like, you know, honestly, the Alden Chukka or the Allen Edmonds Chukka, because they kind of like want that with like a little slight adjustment or something. Try to do something that fit good, that aesthetically, it just kind of like made sense to me the way that it, the pattern came together. And then when I wore it, it was very comfortable. You know, it didn't really have any issues with like biting the ankle or biting your Achilles and stuff. So that was pretty important. You know, so you can kind of take all the issues we've had with other patterns and kind of keep making a checklist and make sure your next pattern doesn't, you know, replicate those issues again.
The iterative approach here, even when it is a completely different boot, but, you know, you learn from something else. So you're still pushing forward, even though you're not maybe making some quantum leap. I mean, I think it's really interesting and it works. Like I have a pair of your new Chukkas in the tan suede, I guess. I mean, I really dig them. Like, we talked a lot just about that development and how it kind of does look like a shoe from above, but, you know, from the side on the shelf, it's very, very squarely a Chukka. It's got the Grant Stone heft to it, even with the crepe sole, which a lot of Chukkas don't, which I appreciate both, and I definitely appreciate these. And yeah, they're really comfortable. Like, immediately, which is for a casual boot, and I think yours is like upticked casual, I would say, that comfort is very essential. Like, you don't want to have to struggle through this boot that you're just pulling on, ripping those laces with one hand and out the door.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't sell the boot very well. Like, but I do like the end result. I trying to make something like a Chukka that traditionally has two eyelets, I shouldn't say traditionally, but that the majority have two eyelets, it's a pain, right? Because like every other person gets it. And it's like, I have heel slip. I can't tighten it down enough. The laces get loose after I take three steps every single morning. So like try to make it that correct Chukka height and have that feel, yet just not have those issues, you know, that we all kind of know about, right? The Chukkas can be no different than a loafer, right? Just loafers can be tight on your instep, or they can have heel slip, or the entry can be too small, too big. So it's just kind of like all of those things wrapped up into this boot.
Yeah. So these and the boots I'm wearing are in Grant Stone's, you know, wider widths. And theoretically, I'm, you know, an 11D Brannock and generally have taken 10.5D in a lot of things, although I'm kind of starting to play around with that a little more. And so I got these Chukkas in the E width and then these Coffee Diesel boots on the wedge. You talked me into getting them in the triple E, and you're like, no, I know this sounds crazy, but I think you should try it because I have kind of a high instep and the 10.5D Ottawa boots were just kind of killing me. I expected them to break in, but on the instep, they never did. So you're like, roll the dice and, you know, I think you'll be happy with them. And honestly, they're great. Both Ticho and I kind of love loading up boots with really thick socks and finding like a different kind of comfort that way. And that's what I've been doing with these, like even in the summer, kind of mid-thick chup type socks. The ride is great. Like maybe if you had a Tui, I would be a Tui. There's something about the way that you're making your boots and making your widths. And Grandstone obviously has this commitment to stocking boots and producing boots and shoes in wider widths, which is something that a lot of people need and can't find. I think it's really interesting. I think more people should give it a shot. Like, I'm not swimming around in these things. They're like a little big on the Vamp maybe, but I like it. And especially for a casual boot like this, I think it works really well.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out for you because that's kind of what we see the most on the customer service side of things is that whatever people currently wear, they're like, I wear this. And now we have like a very short copy and paste that's like, okay, do you wear that? Now, how does it fit? You know, and then like half the time they come back with, oh yeah, they kind of suck. Like, it's like, well, then they're like, yeah, they're kind of like way too tight. And it's like, well, so you probably wear this size in that shoe. So you should probably wear this in ours, you know? And so like that is a huge thing. And like, when it comes to like who needs an e-width or who needs a triple E, it's really hard to put like into numbers because, you know, 99% of people just wear a medium width. I mean, most brands, you know, I'm talking sneakers here or just footwear in general, they don't have an option. So I've literally seen people like put their foot next to the shoe and be like, this is the one. When you can actually get someone like in the right size, in the right width. And the other thing is like some people are like, well, I'm just an E or I'm just a D. And it's like, well, you could probably wear all three widths in different sizes comfortably. It's like, which one's the best for you? That a lot of people can't wrap their head around that. Like, well, I'm an E, there's no way it could be a triple E. It's not a different product. Like, it's not a different materials or something. It's just slightly different measurements. You know, they're like, well, I've never worn a triple E. And it's like, now you do. It's okay.
Yep, neither had I.
Right. And it's a lot of that comes with my dad's experience of the widths and the sizing and his orthopedic background. But then also, like, we have the opportunity to try different shoes, right? Like, so I've got everything from 9 triple E to 11 D. And I wear a lot of different things. I mean, I've worn them all and all the patterns and different materials. It's not like, oh, I'm an 11D. I can't wear anything else. Or I'm a 10.5D or a 10.5E. I can't wear anything else. It's like, well, a 9.5 triple E sometimes is the best if with a thick sock. It's just the right one. Depending on the leather or the last, I might change it up to a 10.5E or a certain suede. I might be a 10.5D. And then the next thing is like the time of the year, right? So you have people who are like, this is my number. This is it. I'm done. And it's just like, your foot can, I mean, a lot of people could literally wear half a size bigger in the summer than they do in the wintertime, you know, because it's so cold. It's no different than, you know, if people are familiar with watches, I mean, they adjust their watch strap in the summertime, your arm's swollen, right? You're swollen. Your watch is super tight. And then in the wintertime, your wedding band and your watch is like sliding all over the place. So, you know, your foot's like the same exact thing. So, and everyone's different too. I mean, everyone has different like tendencies and the way their body works and how much it actually changes depending on the weather and things. But don't focus on the number and the width like at all. Just kind of put it on. It's like, does it fit or not? Or does this one feel better? We've started this sizing fit line. So people call, you know, we got a cell phone and like my dad literally takes phone calls daily from customers and sits there and like chats with them for 20, 30 minutes talking about what they wear and like suggesting sizes and stuff. And that's definitely the main thing. It's like, I'm a 34 waist, period. And they do the same thing with shoe sizes. Like, I'm a 10D. I know it. I've been wearing the 10D in this brand or these 10.5 and it's Allen Edmonds my whole life. And it's like, yeah, but you're telling me it hurts a little bit or whatever. Like, let's try something different like that. There's nothing really wrong with the Allen Edmonds shoe. Just might need a different size. So let's try to go up half a size. And then, but they're really, really stuck on the size, you know, the actual number itself and kind of sticking with that and stuff. And we really have a hard time confronting people to triple E because they're like, oh no, oh no, it's not that bad. It's not that, it's not like it's a big deal. Like,
no, I mean, I didn't think so either, but I'm living proof over here. And yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people compare your Leo Last to Alden's Berry Last. And the way it looks, I think that there's some similarities. But I would almost compare it more to Alden's True Balance last, which I've had Indies and, you know, other boots in a bunch of different sizes, and I'm trying to find the one that I really like the most, but they all kind of fit, which is really kind of nice. And, you know, with Barry, when you size up too much, it feels too long. Like, that's not what's going on with this Leo Last and Tripoli at all. Although I did, you know, for anybody who's interested in kind of making this move, I'm 11D Brannock, somewhat high instep, which Brannock doesn't really cover. And these are a 10 Tripoli because, you know, generally you can go a little shorter on length as you go up in width for most makers. But would I get a pair of, like, dress Oxfords with the same fit? Probably not. Yeah, for a boot that just doesn't matter quite as much, and it's suede, and I'm not worrying about any bad creasing. Yeah, it's kind of luxurious. It's like when Elaine is driving in Seinfeld with the wide lanes, when they're, like, repainting the highways, and then everything catches on fire. It's like that, but nothing's caught on fire yet.
Well, and it's, do you like that 9 Tripoli, it fits bigger than your 11D, right? I mean, fuller in general. Like, you have more room on your instep and everything else.
10 Tripoli, or but 10 yes. 10
Tripoli, I'm sorry. 10 Tripoli fits fuller than your, right.
I mean, 100%.
Right, right. And so a lot of people have a hard time with that, too. Yeah, they're like, well,
voluminous.
That's going down way too many numbers. There's no way I can fit into a 10. And it's like, well, that 10 Tripoli is going to be bigger than your 11D. And they're just like, that doesn't make sense. It's like, well, I just try it. Just promise.
What doesn't choose? What does?
So Grantstone, you're known for your seconds. You have some of the best seconds. The thing about Grantstone seconds, so, like, as somebody who, you know, a lot of people ask me about, that kind of touches, what's the best value that you could possibly get? You know, so many people in 2021, they want to, like, kind of maximize the stats of like, the value that they're getting on everything, right? One of the things that people, you know, for years have recommended is, like, oh, buy Allen Edmonds seconds, right? That's one of the best, you know, value Goodyear welt shoes that you can get. And that's kind of been replaced in recent years as, you know, Allen Edmonds quality has kind of gone down a little bit. And you guys have kind of come on the scene and you have a pretty good offering of what you call B grades on your site, which, you know, you can explain to us what a B grade actually is, what, you know, what goes into deciding that something is a B grade. And, you know, you sell them for a discounted price. Everybody that I know that has ever received one has said, well, I don't know why this is a B grade. No one really, yeah, like, no one has ever,
so true.
No one's figured out what is making these things B grade.
Nobody's
because
figured
they
it out.
Look just about the same as the A grades that you guys put out. So maybe you can talk us through how stuff is ending up as a B grade. Are there C grades? Like, is there something, you know, what's going on, man?
I would say the best way to put it, and to just to get your first, the main answer out there that I think people are looking for is, we have customers that are very, very specific. And these customers, like, in their defense, they also know that, I mean, they're not buying Edward Green, which is not to say that, like, we're using inferior materials and things like that, which that's not the case. But let's just say finish level of a dress shoe versus Edward Green or something like that. They're not even really putting it in that category. But we do have customers who they'll get a boot, they'll get a shoe, and they won't accept it. And it would be something I'm pretty confident that either of you would be like, I won't be able to see this after 2 hours of wearing. But I honestly think, I mean, those are the customers that keep us in line. It means a lot when we have a customer who is a good customer of ours who has, like, legitimate concerns, but at the same time, you're like, just wear them for a few hours. Like, you won't be able to see this. It's sitting in a box. So there might be a slightly matted part where the shoe is laying on its side. Like, but sometimes they put it in a way and they have this, like, great defense of, yeah, but I don't want it because it looks like this. Like, do you have a pair that looks better? And then you're kind of like, oh shit. Yeah, let me go check. So
we do have more shoes.
It's this fine balance because at the same time, we don't want to create this experience or this fallacy that, like, oh, well, yeah, all of our shoes should be that way. It's like, no, we're using this leather and we have to cut X amount of this leather. And the way that we make the shoes, the way that we package them, the way that we ship them, there's going to be certain little things. Like, that is without a doubt, just because of shipping. They're in transit. That definitely plays a pretty big role because it's not so much about us, like, having this back and forth and who's right, who's wrong. But the reality is the way we currently run our business is you can exchange or return your shoes for free. what we have to do, if we ticket this shoe, okay, there's a small imperfection. If we take this shoe and ship it, is it likely that it's going to come back? Because, you know, I don't know what it is, but I don't want it. Like, I don't want to spend the time to email Grandstone Customer Service to figure out whether this leather is supposed to look like that. That's what we've kind of gone through over the years, is kind of learning. While people say like, oh, I can't tell what's wrong with it, we have basically three ways that shoes end up in B grades. One is from the factory. The kid Eric and Wendy, they're pretty good at quality control. They're, you know, just packing up the shoes and making sure they look good when they check every pair. So they're pretty good there. So like, we don't get a ton of stuff here that's like, we open it up and it's like, what is that cut of Chrome XL? Like, actually, I can't remember the last time that happened. Sometimes we will get shoes that have imperfections just directly from the factory. It could be bad outsole stitching. It could be a loose grain and, I don't know, in a weird spot. The two don't match each other. One has like a perfect grain and one doesn't. So that's a portion of them. The next one is like overlooking it when we're first getting it. And then when we go to ship it, right now, my dad, he's the person doing it every day. And so he's inspecting again. Truth be told, some of these things are just in the gray area. And depending on how you feel that day and whether you just B-graded, you haven't B-graded a pair in a while, it's like, you know what? I don't want to ship this. No. And he B-grades it. And then he's like, well, would you A-grade it? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Depends on the customer. Like some people like it when it has like that in-between color and stuff. No, yeah, you know, let's, you know, if you don't like it, then whatever. So there's a lot of that, because the reality is you're already questioning the quality. Person gets it, and then we have to pay for the shipping both ways, and then a third time to give them a replacement. So it's more like, would anyone have a concern with the shoe? And let's not pretend every single customer is 100% reasonable and understands that blooming is normal and that I'll just buff it out with Venetian. It's like, a lot of people don't have Venetian, you know? So it's like, I'd say our B grades are good. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they're that much better than other people's B grades, I would say. But we definitely have an ability to B grade more pairs and be more specific, because we're shipping, let's say, a 1,000th of the shoes of Allen Edmonds, right? And it's literally one person shipping and inspecting. They see things day to day. And when they get returns back, I mean, Dad's like, well, you returned it because of this, you know? And it's like, that makes an impact of what he's shipping that day. He's like, you know, tightens it up again for a few days. Hey, the logo, the emboss on the outsole, it's too close to the heel. It's too close to the side, you know, something like that, which literally we might go a year without really catching too many of those issues. And then one customer kind of points it out and it's like, hey, look, you got to watch this again. And, you know, we got to make sure the factory knows this is kind of, you know, so there's a lot of that going on. It kind of comes in waves. You know, we've had that plenty of times where someone says like, I can't tell what's wrong with it. It's like, well, this gentleman, Joey, just returned it a week ago because he said it was awful. So it's really customer specific. And for us, it's a numbers game that you have to kind of play. But then if we can't give that customer that product they're looking for, that particular level of quality, I should say, or detail, then we just have to tell them, because we're like, look, we could ship you all three of these pairs, but you're going to have the same problem. This is kind of what the product is. And so that one's a tough one to kind of tell them sometimes and everything else. But most of the time you're met with, well, thanks for at least letting me know. I'm going to go buy them, you know, this brand now. It's like, all right, okay. Because it's tough, right? And it's not like they're wrong. It's just the stuff you see people selling out of a store. People can come into a store and buy something that has gravel pits in the leather sole and they'll buy it from a retail shop, no problem. You cannot put that in a box and ship it to a consumer. They'd be like, you just sold me pre-owned shoes. It would never pass. But, you know, out of a store, you have someone talking to you and you say, hey, look, someone tried these on for 2 seconds, literally didn't walk in them. They stood in them and took them off. Didn't even lace them. They're like, yeah, I don't care. That's fine.
It's like, we have a lot of gravel on the floor of the store for some reason.
Yeah, strange choice for a shoe store. Carpet is usually preferred, but apparently, yeah, Grantstone innovating on the shoe store gravel pit location.
Grantstone ex Wu-Tang.
You go into a retail shop and look at what's on the shelf, and I'm $700 shoes. There's vamp creases, and people will buy those off the shelf. No problem. They will buy them. Every single store I've ever been to, you will have that to a certain extent. You're going to have like a vamp crease or something. And again, shipping that as an A grade, that is a problem for us 100%. And I would say for most people shipping to the customer.
I've never really thought about that, but yeah, like in the store, you're trying them on. You're more worried about fit. You're looking at the top of the shoe while you're wearing it, and then a good salesman gets you out the door. You know, theoretically, that's your inspection, but you don't really do it because you're worried about all these other things. But when it shows up in the box, you're like, oh, okay, here we go. Yeah. I don't know. I think you gave a wonderfully modest answer there, because I haven't heard anybody complain about anything, and the prices are just straight up insane. So bravo, I guess.
I think people have different expectations from buying something online versus buying in a store, where you go to a store, you're kind of expecting an experience, whereas if you're buying something online, you're expecting a product. The product is the thing that is scrutinized, versus in the store, you're kind of scrutinizing the whole experience, everything that's going on, who's helping you, what the whole vibe there. If you buy something online, it's, you know, there's the packaging and stuff like that. Obviously, that's important. But like, yeah, it's all about just, I bought this thing. I've been, you know, you've been tracking the package. You're obsessing about it. You're like, ah, I hope everything works out with this, you know. And then you get it and it's like, yeah, let's just, you know, scrutinize that. I do it too. I got these pair of country derbies. They showed up in my house and it's like, yeah, let me see what Grantstone is all about. Let me kind of scrutinize the heck out of these things. And I'm like, well, these look pretty clean. I'm pretty easy to please, but like, even for that, I was like, this is a super clean, tightly finished pair of shoes. I'm like, great, pop them on my feet and go. Sometimes things show up and they don't meet your expectations and you're kind of like, you start sweating it. You start sending pictures to your buddies. You post it on Reddit or something. Like, is this supposed to look like this? You know? And it's like, yeah, like maybe yes, maybe no. You know, sometimes it turns into a tough decision, but preemptively being on top of, you know, picking out anything that could remotely get somebody's dander up on that and cutting down on returns and stuff, I think is pretty smart, and the customers appreciate it. And then the guys who are trying to get something for a good deal are feasting on these B grades. So it seems like it's overall an ecosystem that's kind of working for everybody. So nice work, man. Yeah.
Great job. All right, last one. We sometimes forget, but we try and ask everybody this. If you had to get rid of all your shoes and boots, like you have to, and you only get to keep one pair forever, and you get a pair of sneakers for the gym, which are you keeping?
I appreciate you think that I go to the gym. Thanks so much.
You look great. People can't see the video, but man, I mean, this tank top you're wearing, it's really working for you.
I would say a soft upper on a loafer. I'm cheating there. You know, okay, let's say...
pick one.
A brown suede penny loafer.
That's strong. Yeah.
It's a pretty good choice.
It's the ultimate travel shoe, because I like to think that I travel, even though I don't travel anymore. It's not even a thing, but it's a great travel shoe. After work, during the office, you know, walking around, you know, it's incredibly convenient. It kind of goes with everything. It's probably one of our shoes. It's like the one of our, or just any brand, I should say, that like, to me, it's fairly easy to pull off wearing something with shorts all the way to a suit. You know, I think you can wear like a nice suit with a penny loafer. Sometimes it's hard to do with like a plain toe blucher, even long wings. They can kind of look big. Yeah. It's a lot of shoe versus like obviously just getting an Oxford. So I feel like a loafer is fairly easy to wear with just about everything. Yeah. I can't imagine pick anything else. And even the winter time in Michigan, I still wear loafers, so not a big deal.
That's bold.
Excellent. Very, very well thought out choice. Promise that would be the last question, except for this one. What do you think the true Gen Fact is? To refresh, Gen Fact number one, Andrew Carnegie Negi first put steel shanks in boots. Gen Fact number two, vamps on shoes are to protect from tiny little forest vampires in Germany. Gen Fact number three, in England's classiest period, the Victorian era, everybody was hurling shoes at people who just got married. What do you guys think?
For the first one, like, that's such a small amount of steel to be, like, getting really excited about. This is a new branch of my steel business. We're building skyscrapers, but, like, let's also put these tiny little things inside shoes.
There's more shoes than skyscrapers.
Andrew Carnegie, noted very good businessman, and that just doesn't seem like a great business decision to me. The vampire thing, I don't know, maybe German vampires are different. We'll have to ask our buddy Giovanni from the Discord. He knows probably about German vampires.
I think they're all different.
They're probably a little bit different, but like, I don't know that they're nibbling feet versus like drinking blood, you know? Like, German fairy tales are terrifying. Like, why would their version be less terrifying?
I mean, it is terrifying because you can't see them and, you know, they get you through your Crocs.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know how popular Crocs are in Germany. Maybe that would inform how I would think about this fact. But I'm going to go for number three. We got it last week with like the Victorian shoe traditions. I think throwing shoes has a long history of being great. Shout out to that guy who threw that shoe at George W. Bush. So I'm going to go for Gen Fact number three. I think getting a shoe thrown at you, unless you're George W. Bush, is definitely a sign of good luck.
Two are true and one's false, or is the opposite?
Two are false, one's true.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to say the one about the shank. That was so in depth. Whoever made that as a false, I mean, that's a lot of work. So I feel like that would be true. And yeah, the other two, the vampire thing is absolutely crazy. So if that one's true too, that's awesome. But
here's the real question. Here's the real question. What if the vampire one is really true?
Sorry, are you trying to break news on a shoe podcast about vampires being real right now? Is that the position you're taking?
100%.
Okay. Okay.
That would provide us with a nice rush of audience. We can get up to maybe number 12 on the Finnish podcast hit list.
I would imagine that would go viral if we really knew and really had information about that.
And guess what? It's not going to. And Wyatt, you got my friend.
Yes!
It's throwing shoes.
Yes.
Shoe throwing. Ticho, you are gen facting well this season. But I feel like all the guests are getting fooled. You have more experience. It's not surprising.
I do. That's true. That's fair.
Yeah, I don't know if I got married in England.
They're throwing shoes at you, man. That's great. Yeah.
Free shoes. I don't know if you got to keep the shoes or what, but that's a real one.
Think about how many B grades you could sell before weddings, Wyatt. Yeah, and if I'm doing this, I really want to hit hard. I need something solidly built like a grantstone to really make my wishes of good luck known.
2.5 pound shoe, that's painful.
That'd be rough, man. Yeah.
Wild parties. They know how to get after it. All right. We got Jen's number this season. I'm not mad about it, but I feel like he's just going to strike back even harder. Look, unfortunately, we got to call it right there, but huge thanks to Standard and Strange for sponsoring this episode and also the Stitch Down Patina Thunderdome. All our Thunderdome sponsors are incredible and generous and very attractive. Each week we'll be thanking another one. This week it's Dr. Soul, who makes some of the very finest outsoles that I have on, like, I don't know, 70% of my boots these days, it feels like. They've so kindly donated a free resole service to a lucky winner, so get on to picking a new pair of boots or shoes, and don't you dare wear them, except for trying them on inside to make sure they fit, until October 1st, when the Thunderdome begins. But most importantly, huge thanks to Wyatt for coming on. This was excellent, my man.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. And Vic Tao, she's awesome, by the way. She was like one of our first customers in Taiwan.
No way. I love it.
Yeah, she bought like a Dune diesel boot back in like 2016 or something like that. And
I think she still has them.
Yeah, she does. And at that time, I mean, we didn't know each other or anything like that. And I'm not sure how it all happened, but she ended up buying a pair and we shipped them over there. And she's really cool.
Look, Wyatt, thanks again. That's it for this week on the ShoeCast. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.